Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was the best book you were ever forced to read in school, and what would convince you to go back to it? My guest this hour has treasured books his whole life, but he admits that he tended to buck against the literature he was required to read as a student because he felt like all that classroom discussion and dissection took the joy out of reading great stories. But by returning to them on his own terms as an adult, he has, in a sense, rediscovered all they have to offer, and he shares his enthusiasm in his new book. Kevin Smokler has written for the Los Angeles Times, Fast Company, and the San Francisco Chronicle. His book is called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
So how does it happen, do you think, that adolescents get turned off to the very books that our society holds in the greatest esteem?
Oh, I think it's something about the classroom setting. And no slag to educators and teachers out there. I began Practical Classics by calling all of my own high school teachers after 20 years and saying, "Hi, remember me? What did you assign me in high school? Because I'm going to dive in and do it all over again." But I think there's something about taking something which was once perceived as fun, and this is what happened in my case. Reading was something I did with the same joy as playing miniature golf or video games or eating fast food, and then suddenly in the ninth grade it became something that to be tested and essayed upon and something that showed up on final exams. And taken in that context felt like getting socked with a final exam on roller coaster physics after going to the amusement park. And I think, you know, it's only natural that someone remembers Tale of Two Cities or King Lear or Pride and Prejudice in that context and says, well, now that I'm out of high school and in the real world, I never need to do that again. It has bad memories for me. The hope is that that's not what happens forever.
What criteria did you apply when you were choosing the works you discuss here?
Well, first, like I said, first I called my own high school teachers and asked what they had assigned me. And then I tried to make sure pretty much everything in Practical Classics was something that someone could conceivably say, oh, yes, I remember getting assigned this in high school or hearing of this as a high school book. And then I wanted this book to be multi-generational. I graduated in 1991, and I didn't want this to just be, oh, here are some books Kevin read in high school. That's not very interesting. So there are books my parents' generation read in high school. We did not read a separate piece when I was a teenager, but my mom did. And then there were some books that I have a feeling kids in high school are reading now, like Sherman Alexie's Reservation Blues.
So first on your list is The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which you see not only as a novel about race and relationships, but about the process of reaching maturity in a complicated world.
Absolutely. You know, I had remembered when Huck Finn was written completely wrong. I was convinced, like, Huck Finn landed in the bookstore, like, the day the Civil War ended.
Huh.
And in fact, it landed in the bookstore 20 years later, in 1884, and was about, like, the 1840s. So that would be the same if Huck Finn was written today. It would be about the late Eisenhower administration. And I was also convinced that the whole book was a lot more sentimental than it actually was. I thought it was a great, you know, song to taking raft trips with your best friends and staying out too late at night. And actually, that's what Tom Sawyer feels like. But Huck Finn, it feels like, it is a lot darker and scarier than that. The world of Huck Finn is the world of slavery and drunken fathers who beat on you. And so I think what I got from that is Mark Twain, who, by the way, was going through his first decade of middle age when he wrote Huck Finn, was actually saying, Huck and I, Mark Twain, and America has grown up significantly, and we are, in fact, better for it.
And I guess the fact that we still debate whether the story is very progressive or very racist points to the fact that we still face a lot of ambivalence about race as a society.
Oh, absolutely so. There are whole books written on exactly why Huck Finn has been so controversial. Around the time it came out, no less a literary talent than Louisa May Alcott called it a piece of filth no child should ever be exposed to. Ironic, because Louisa May Alcott was an expert in writing filth. It was her favorite genre was erotica before she published Little Women. But that was what Huck Finn was first banned for, and then around the 50s and 60s it was banned for liberal use of the N-word. And then in the 90s, again, it was banned as an unsympathetic portrayal of a person of color. the fact that the book keeps resonating with us and keeps either rubbing us the right or wrong way throughout its 130-year history right now is one of the first signs I look for when calling something a classic, a book that, as it has been famously said, never runs out of things to say.
Did Twain intend to write that as a book for children in the same way that Tom Sawyer was for children?
I don't think so. I'm not positive on that, but he intended to write it immediately after Tom Sawyer and struggled for 8 years to sort of get Huck Finn down on paper, and in the meantime wrote two other books. God, if we could only all be that productive. and those books were both nostalgic looks at his 20s and 30s. So I have a feeling, although I couldn't say for sure, and thankfully now we have his giant autobiography to provide some insight, but I have a feeling it was a book maybe written about childhood, but definitely from the point of view of a middle-aged man.
So what do we get from returning to Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings?
Well, you know, I don't know why this didn't occur to me when I reread it, because it's simple mathematics, but Maya Angelou was in her early 40s when she wrote I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. She had lived the entire life that was in not only Caged Bird, but the five volumes, the five sequels of it that followed. So Maya Angelou lived an entire second life writing about her first life.
Mm.
And it's almost as if she reclaimed everything she happened that happened in the first half of her life as an artist, and not just as a person, sort of recounting and rehashing what had happened to them. I think it says a whole lot about growing up and how we take our own pasts into account and make something out of them.
Yeah, and you point out the fact that it's not simply a revisiting of the past, but a celebration of how far she has come.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, the original poem that the title I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is based on is by Paul Laurence Dunbar. And Maya Angelou rewrites it or sort of adapts it for in the text of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and changes the last lines to I'm totally going to get this wrong. Forgive me, Dr. Angelou and Chris, something. She changes the words from sings and sings on to sings and sings of freedom, as if the act of capturing artistically one's past is taking control of it and freeing oneself from it.
Does the artistic value of the book measure up to the strength of its message?
I think I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is one of the great memoirs of growing up in childhood, and not only because we see both the young person and the adult present in the text, which I think is a rarity with memoir. I think it is definitely the best book of the six, and I think the other five volumes of Dr. Angelou's memoirs are of varying quality, but I think I personally feel like Caged Bird holds up beautifully.
Well, I ask that because there are many people really love this book, but there have been critics who've said, you know, who've questioned the use of language and that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think Francine Prose wrote a rather cutting review in Harper's when it came out, basically saying something along the lines of "I know why the Caged Bird sings, and I wish the Caged Bird would shut up." And there has been significant criticism that it feels like a first book. It gets entirely too much credit because it came along at the right time. And that the prose is rather overwrought and flabby. I don't know. I would hardly position myself as a literary critic. I'm more of just an enthusiastic reader, and I find if I can come back to something over and over again and not feel slightly guilty coming back to it, like I'm, you know, revisiting junior high school and shooting baskets on the court where I once triumphed or something like that. I feel like the book holds up if I don't feel slightly unseemly coming back to it and still liking it.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't gone back to it myself, but maybe it works to the extent that when I read it as a teenager, I was just astonished by how much I loved it.
Yeah, you know, I guess I slightly cheated with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings because it was first given to me my freshman year in college, and I had somehow missed Maya Angelou entirely in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember it was one of those books I kind of slipped in over the summer when, you know, I probably should have been working at my summer job, And I still remember how much it moved me.
Author Kevin Smokler is with us. He's written for the Los Angeles Times, Fast Company, and the San Francisco Chronicle. His new book is called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. If you've got a title to discuss or recommend, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll talk much more with Kevin Smokler in just a few minutes. Right now, though, we want to remind you, if you have if it has slipped your mind, that we are in the midst of the spring membership campaign here at KERA. When we raise the funding necessary to keep the station strong for the next few months, I'm joined here in the studio by executive producer Jeff Whittington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to mention to everybody that you can get your very own copy of Kevin's book, Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School, with your contribution to KERA today. Call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. $10 a month contribution, which is $120 all at once, and we'll thank you with your very own copy of Kevin's book. This is when I saw this book was coming out, Chris, I thought, oh, this is perfect for our audience because, you know, we all like to discuss these things, and we know that you do too. So we'd love to be able to thank you with a copy of the book.
And this book is really meta, I think, for Think listeners, because so many of you tell us that your reading list is influenced by what you hear on the show. Now you will have a book that has 50 books that you might want to go back and read again or maybe discover for the first time. So give us a call now. Choose that as your thank you gift with a $10 a month contribution at 1-888-694-6931 or go to kera.org online. Looking for 25 contributions in this hour of Think. We have 23 left to go. This should be easy because we know there are thousands of you listening out there, some of whom have still to become members of the station or perhaps renew a membership this time. We'd love to hear from you now.
Hey, this morning, Chris, we heard from Eric Hill in Dallas, who said, you know, the in the comments field, when he made his contribution, he said, this is the tragedy of the commons. One of your 95% freeloaders finally turning into your supporting 5%, and it only took me 45 years.
Good for you.
Now, these are Eric's words. Eric says, your listeners are all bums just like me. The economics of it all are not particularly favorable. He says, but thank you for trying so hard for all of us. Cheers. So thank you, Eric, for getting on board. You know what?
You're always welcome. Yeah. It's never too late.
It's never too late to join KERA. And thank you so much, Eric, for your support. We'd like to thank you with your call to 888-694-6931. We can do that. Just like Mary and Ron Bradford in Dallas. Thanks so much, Mary and Ron. We heard from Bipasha Ashok. Bipasha and Ashok Mukherjee, actually, in Irving. Thank you so much, Bipasha and Ashok. We would love to hear from you. Love to read your name, but you got to call for us to do it. 888-694-6931.
Thank you, Steve and Kathy Brawley, Wichita Falls, who maybe went online to kera.org or maybe called. Thanks, Jennifer Reed in Trophy Club, Megan James Yoss in Stephenville, Christine Dollahan and Thomas Campbell in Dallas, Audrey Lewis in Dallas. Thank you, Jenny and Charles Kruger in Caddo Mills. Really appreciate it.
And don't forget, the BNSF Foundation is offering KERA an additional $5,000 in cold hard cash to pay for the programming that you love and enjoy and rely upon every single day. We've got to have at least 350 contributions today in order to achieve that. Well, we've got about 200 contributions to go, Chris, so the 25 we need during Think This Hour will get us more than 10% of the way there. So please be the next one to click and join at kera.org or to call us.
Look, think about it this way. That $5,000 buys $5,000 worth of the programming that you love. So if this challenge grant comes to KERA, the real beneficiary is you. Give us a call at 1-888-694-6931 or go online and make your contribution at kera.org.
And we won't use it for ice cream or anything.
No, we won't.
No, promise.
Tempted as we are.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author and reader Kevin Smokler. His new book is called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Just a couple here via email. The Peloponnesian Wars by Thucydides came in from David. Let's see. And we have Moby Dick. Tom Moore in Fort Worth says, one of the other English teachers in high school assigned this, and it sounded so great to me growing up in a small Gulf Coast city in Texas. Later, I read it between watches on a destroyer as a young sailor fresh out of high school in Uncle Sam's Navy. It is still one of my all-time favorite books. And you recommend here not Moby Dick, but Bartleby the Scrivener.
Yeah. I unfortunately, Chris, I only had 10 months to do this book, which meant that something of the heft of Moby Dick or of Middlemarch or of the great Russian novelists had to go. I'm simply not a fast enough reader to fit it in. But I'm so happy that people keep recommending Moby Dick to me, because I feel like Moby Dick is sort of a long lost friend that I've never met, and I'm doing Practical Classics to me was like coming to a reunion of people of old friends saying, hey, remember me, look how much we've both changed, and look what we still have to learn from each other.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Gabe on the line in Denton. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, Chris. How are you guys today?
Great, thank you.
Hi, Gabe.
I wanted to say that, first of all, great topic, and some of these books are some of my all-time favorites. But the one that I would definitely recommend is 451 by Ray Bradbury.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's just a great commentary of what happens to people when they stop making decisions for themselves. And I wonder what your caller would like to say about that. I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, it makes Kevin's list, so he's got lots to say.
Yes, it does. And thank you, Gabe. I did reread Fahrenheit 451, and I did it along with a couple of biographical sketches of Ray Bradbury. And what I was shocked by is, unlike George Orwell's 1984, that there's no big brother in Fahrenheit 451. The crimes against books are all perpetuated by working people. By firemen instead of fire chiefs. And I ended up locating Fahrenheit 451 in my section on working, because it seemed to me just as much about not only the thoughtlessness of people, who've sort of been deadened by entertainment, but also of Guy Montag and how much he's been deadened by his job. And I thought Fahrenheit 451 would be a great book to reread if you were thinking about switching jobs, because to me it seems to say a whole lot about what happens when your job eats away at your soul. But what a wonderful book. I could reread it 10 more times.
I love that you recommend Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter while admitting right in your essay title that you don't like it either.
No. I just feel like that book and I were not meant to be friends. And that's okay. I don't think every book out there is meant to give us a hug or make us feel comforted. I think some of them are meant to make us angry or frustrate us or challenge us. And even though I'm probably never going to go back to The Scarlet Letter, the reason it's in Practical Classics is it's kind of a stand-in for the very act of difficult reading. Because I think if we view reading as a sumptuous feast rather than, a bowl of peanuts, there are some parts of it that are sweet, and some parts of it are sour, and some parts of it that go down easy, and some that burn the throat a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that's all part of the richness of it.
And it's interesting, too, because we seem to have a harder time sometimes. There are people who feel like they ought to be reading all things that burn when they go down, that are challenging, in a way that we don't struggle so much with our viewing of television and movies. We understand that we can watch a Lincoln and we can watch I hesitate to name a dumb movie that I've seen because it will ruin my reputation, but, Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, and it doesn't necessarily, detract from our ability to take in the tough stuff.
No. Chris, I can't tell you how many times in the course of, chatting with people about Practical Classics, I've had people sort of clutch me by the hand and whisper in my ear, Kevin, what can we do to get people to take books more seriously? To which I say, first of all, I'm flattered that they think I have some sort of control over that. And then I say, no, sir or ma'am, what we need is for people to take books far less seriously. What we need is for people to look at reading not only as good for us, but for the wild act of pleasure that it actually is. I don't think we have any trouble viewing reading as Brussels sprouts. I think we have a lot of trouble viewing it as chocolate also. And I think we lose nothing by viewing by seeing the act of reading and literature as something that gives us pleasure as well as intellect. We seem to have no problem doing that with music or film or television or theater or anything else. I don't know why we're such sourpusses when it comes to books.
You call And the Band Played On your favorite book of all, and in fact the book that inspired you ultimately to become a writer yourself.
Yes, yes. Being the deluded, spoiled brat I was in high school, and thinking none of my teachers should waste my time with education, I graduated from high school and I said, "Sayonara to all of you! I'm going to college, and I'm never going to read anything again that someone makes me." And I not only threw the baby out with the bathwater, I think I threw the crib and the mobile and the nursery and everything out with the bathwater, and said, "I'm never going to read anything again." And it was my junior year in college when a friend of mine handed me a copy of And the Band Played On, which is a nonfiction book about the first decade of the AIDS crisis in this country, and said, "Please read this because it's my favorite book." And to which I said, "I don't do such things because I'm a busy 20-year-old person." And she said, "No, I really need you to." And I said, "Okay." And I read a page at a time, and it took me 6 months. And at the end, I said, "My God, this is really what my life has been missing, and I have not been without a book since." So I really feel like that book saved me from an adulthood without books and contributed a great deal to where I am today and why I'm talking to you.
I can't imagine any higher praise ever for anything that's ever been written down.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I feel like I owe Randy Schultz my entire life, and every year I buy a copy of that book and I take a walk over to the AIDS Memorial Grove in Golden Gate Park, and I just leave a copy of it there for whoever comes by, and we'll receive the same. Hopefully, we'll receive some of the gifts from it that I did.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Valerie in Dallas. Hi, Valerie.
Hi.
Hi, Valerie.
Hi, how are you? I just love what y'all are talking about today.
Oh,
and when I heard it, I had to think, because very recently I picked up a copy of Lord of the Flies, which I was given to read in high school and really loved. I read it probably 20 times between high school and college and lost it and never really thought about it again, and picked it up maybe sometime within the last year. And it was so much more frightening to me as an adult than it had been as a child, or as a late teenager, early 20s. I thought it was really fascinating, maybe because I could, you know, relate to the horror that children can visit upon each other a little bit more. But then as an adult, now that I have children, it was so much more frightening and so much more moving and very challenging to get through, even to get to the end. And I thought it was wonderful.
Thanks so much for your call, Valerie. That's not in your book, Kevin, but I wonder if you've reread Lord of the Flies recently.
I haven't, but I think what Valerie gets my wheels turning about is I think it's fascinating to read books about kids when you are no longer a kid, or even when you're a parent and now have your own kids. And because you can not only see where you came from if you read it as a young person, but you can see sort of the young person that was you in the rearview mirror, and you can see the young person you're playing a role in bringing into adulthood. One of the things, I'm fascinated by reading books about kids now as a grown-up, be it To Kill a Mockingbird or a Separate Piece, which are in practical classics, or books like Lord of the Flies or The Chocolate War and stuff like that, which are not. And one of my great hopes, and I hope Valerie is doing this with her kids, is that people take the chance to reread classics that their kids are assigned in school and to see how that experience matches up.
Well, you do list Catcher in the Rye here, which I remember reading in high school, and all of us were like, "Oh, finally, a cool book." And I went to high school just a few years before you did, but it sounds like you've discovered that kids today think this is hopelessly old-fashioned and that they can't relate to it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I gave a quick look on Amazon under Catcher in the Rye, and there's about 100 one-star reviews, all from high school students. I'm guessing, but I'm going to say all from high school students. And the complaints are all that Holden Caulfield is a big spoiled brat of a crybaby who doesn't really have as many problems as you think he does, and he should just kind of toughen up and wipe away his tears and get on with life. And I think, you know, the world that Holden Caulfield occupied was one of significantly more privilege, not only economic but racial and gender and regional and those sorts of things. The American high school student is, the perspectives of the American high school student are far more diverse now than they were 50 years ago when that book was being written. I got to tell you though, Chris, I was convinced that was one of those books with like a built-in self-destruct button.
Like it wouldn't work the second time around.
Yeah, like you graduate from high school and the book just kind of evaporates into dust. It has nothing for you at that point. What helped me come back to it was the notion, and I'll ask you this question: how many siblings does Holden Caulfield have?
Did he have a brother? An older brother?
He has an older brother, D.B., who's a screenwriter in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had Phoebe, of course, the younger sister we know. But he had a younger brother named Allie, who has just died before this book begins. And right before he, in that immortal scene when he meets Phoebe at the Museum of Natural History, he's wandering over there from the other side of Central Park saying, "Please, Allie, don't let me disappear."
Hmm.
And J.D. Salinger wrote this book, you know, not in the heat of the teenage anti-hero. It was before rock and roll. It was before Rebel Without a Cause. But instead, during World War II, when he was a soldier in Normandy and saw dozens of his friends die. So this entire book carries with it the shadow of death, which leads me to believe that maybe Holden Caulfield isn't such a bratty, spoiled kid after all. Maybe he's just a person who's grieving.
Hmm. Boy, I didn't remember any of those details. That's very interesting, and maybe I'll have to go back to it these 30 years later.
Yeah, I had to read it 14 times before Allie, you know, appeared to me.
Yeah. Kevin Smokler is with us. He's the author of a new book called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. We'll talk more with Kevin in a couple of minutes, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. If you would like to read a copy of Practical Classics, add that to your library and help you guide your reading, and also support KERA. You can do both at the same time when you go online now to kera.org or call in to 1-888-694-6931. We're offering Practical Classics as a thank you gift at the $10 a month level. You can do this also with a one-time $120 gift. I, for one, like the sustaining membership because it just doesn't cost very much at a time.
Yeah, it's very, very easy to support the station when it comes automatically off your credit card or out of your account. So do your part right now by calling 888-694-6931.
Jeff Whittington, of course, was the voice that you just heard. He is the executive producer of Think and a lot of other projects around here. I want to remind you that we have a special challenge from the BNSF Foundation today. They're offering an additional $5,000 to KERA if we can drum up 350 contributions in any amount today. This money benefits you as well as the station because, of course, anything good that happens to KERA, we like to turn into programming. So when we have extra money, we like to spend it on the things that you care about. So make your contribution now. It's really important today at kera.org.
You probably noticed that we've been expanding our operation here at KERA. We have hired two new reporters. Soon we'll have a digital producer and blogger as well on the team. And that's your contributions being translated into people working on your behalf, people able to go out and cover what's going on. You know, when the West explosion happened, a couple of weeks ago, we were able to have a reporter on the scene pretty much for 4 days straight, 4 to 5 days straight, during the entire aftermath, covering what was happening, the real stories of not just of the tragedy, but of the hope and the sharing and the good neighborliness that happened down there and the outpouring of support from all over North Texas and really from around the world. We were able to bring you those stories firsthand because we had the staff and the equipment and the means and the know-how, thanks to your generous support over the years, to get it done. And that's what we're able to do when you make your contribution right now at 888-694-6931. make a $120 contribution. We'll thank you with a copy of Practical Classics. And we'll also thank you every single day by bringing you the absolute best programming that radio has to offer.
Make no mistake, your dollars, the money that you contribute to this station, makes you every bit as important a member of the team as anyone who creates programming here or keeps the station running technically. The money matters. It's the only way we could possibly serve not only you and your family, but the entire North Texas community, the only way we could put up this great online presence. Your contributions to KERA.org make you almost like a staff member here. 1-888-694-6931.
Our goal this hour, 25 contributions in any amount, either on the phone at 888-694-6931. Or on the web at kera.org. Chris, we've heard from a few folks looking for 9 more contributions by 1 o'clock to stay on track to make the 350 that's needed to unlock this BNSF Foundation contribution of $5,000 to the station.
So make your contribution right now. Receive perhaps a copy of Practical Classics by Kevin Smokler. If you've already got a copy or you want a different thank you gift, you can find others at kera.org. You can make a contribution in any amount. So if maybe you're already a member, but you want to help us achieve our goal of 25 contributions this hour, we have 6 to go. You could go right now and just make a small additional gift or a large additional gift. Or, of course, you can become a member for the very first time. It's really easy to do. You just go to kera.org and click, and you'll find, if there's a button right there, and you'll be done with the whole transaction within about a minute and a half.
Yeah, I think on any page at kera.org, you can find a button.
We make that very
that will take you to
one thing that counts
to the contribution place. It's very easy to do. It's a very safe and secure, and you can do it very efficiently. It just takes about 90 seconds, maybe a little bit longer if you want to peruse the available thank you gifts. Or hey, you can call and talk to a friendly person at 888-694-6931. Got an email from somebody the other day, Chris, who said, "Jeff, please say the phone number slowly. Remember, some people are driving." I was a little worried about that, but maybe it's just so you can remember it when you get to a light or pull over to make that call. So please make that call safely at 888-694-6931.
Well, you're a musician, so be thinking about this. For the next break, I want you to have come up with a tune, and we can set this to music.
I jingle on command.
All right. Well, we don't have time for that now, but we will do it the next time we come back. 888-694-6931 is the spoken word version, or you can go to kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kevin Smokler, who's written for the LA Times, Fast Company, and the San Francisco Chronicle, among other publications. His new book is called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I thought this was interesting. You recommend The Bell Jar not so much as a book about making peace with how to die as about a fierce struggle to live.
Yes. I read that book in the dead of winter. I was in artist residency in Chicago in January. You can imagine what that was like. 14 inches of snow on the ground. And I don't know how much the narrator Esther Greenwood is a stand-in for Sylvia Plath, but I just remember saying that this character is no wimp. This character is dying to be better and live better than she is, and she's in this fierce struggle with her mind. And that to me is what is at the burning heart of that book. There's nothing gentle about The Bell Jar at all.
Yeah.
The Bell Jar it's like every time you open the book, a needle is stabbing at you. And the intensity of it is what really stuck with me.
And it took some courage to make Esther Greenwood not very easy to like.
No. I mean, people have debated since that book was published as to whether Esther Greenwood is likable. To me, the story is twice as powerful if she's not likable, and yet we are absolutely captivated by what happens to her. It's far too easy to to, it would have been far too easy for Ms. Plath to say, oh, this is a really nice person who has terrible things happening to her. I really think you should pay attention because you're a decent human being. Instead, there's a much greater artistic challenge in saying, this is someone you really wouldn't want to have dinner with or invite over for tea, but I'm going to make you care about what happens to her, and she does.
David Foster Wallace's A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. Brilliant gift there for observation.
Yeah, absolutely. For those who don't know, this, of course, is a 90-page essay about a cruise ship trip that David Foster Wallace took and about the experience he has on that cruise ship. David Foster Wallace considered himself a fiction writer who did these sorts of nonfiction escapades to pay the bills. Hmm. And so I put A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again in the section of Practical Classics about working, because to me it showed an example not only of what David Foster Wallace was doing that he did not consider his full-time job, but also the essay is rife with examples of other cruise ship passengers working extremely hard at relaxing. and that this, you know, multi-million-dollar cruise ship is micromanaged within an inch of its life to make sure you are never working at anything for 1 second, even opening the beer bottle that is served with your meal by yourself.
Well, and I think we can all relate to that pressure, like, I've only got a week of vacation and it better count.
Right. I better cram everything into this week when I'm not supposed to be doing anything.
Right.
It has been disputed whether David Foster Wallace belongs in a book about classics. And I think maybe the sad truth is, because we lost him earlier than perhaps we wanted to, that he will be read in high schools sooner because of that.
I was surprised but delighted to see The Phantom Tollbooth on your list.
Oh, yes. I will admit there was a couple of times in the 10 months of writing Practical Classics when I was terrified that I was going to run out of time. So there are at least three books in there that I have reread so many times that I actually did not have to reread them. And The Phantom Tollbooth is one. Because The Phantom Tollbooth has pictures, and because wonderful illustrations by Jules Pfeiffer, and because we mostly encounter it in elementary school, one could dispute whether it belongs in a book about books you supposedly are rereading from high school. However, I think The Phantom Tollbooth is one of the great books about learning ever, and it is in fact vitally important for the world we live in now, where we see sort of learning and having fun as two separate things. And what The Phantom Tollbooth argues is that learning and becoming smarter is the greatest adventure of them all, and should be just as much chocolate as it is Brussels sprouts, to drag in that metaphor from earlier.
And I think there's a certain amount of sort of pride that really bright kids will take in understanding the references and, you know, not having to go to the dictionary too many times to sort of figure things out. It's almost like an inside club.
Yes. Chris, I know you have I heard the show with Scott Simon, and I know you have a daughter that's probably Phantom Tollbooth age right about now. And kids today, one of the things I got from writing Practical Classics is that kids today are infinitely smarter than I was when I was in high school. And I probably missed 99% of what was in The Phantom Tollbooth the first time around. I think I got the fact that the humbug said bah a whole lot, and that was about it. But I totally missed that there was an island you jump to called Conclusions, because you jump to conclusions, and that the conductor of the orchestra, rides in a silent chariot because it goes without saying. I think Phantom Tollbooth is a great book to read with one's kids, because Norman Juster, the author himself, says when he talks to adults, people with their own kids, they always say, now I understand it. I didn't get most of the jokes the first time around.
And I love this. To Kill a Mockingbird, on top of everything else, every other reason that we have to love it, is a story with an underlying thread about an incredibly good father.
Absolutely. You know, it is my fondest wish that come Father's Day in June, that people give dads give dads To Kill a Mockingbird, because To Kill a Mockingbird is told in flashback. Another thing I missed the first time around, but the sense I get is that the Scout Finch that is telling us the story is about Harper Lee's age when she wrote the book. She was 30 when she wrote the book. And in addition to being a story about a trial and racial injustice and growing up, I think it's very much a story about a person who, it's very much a tribute to a parent, and Harper Lee saying, you know what, look what I did. I turned out okay, and it was largely thanks to you. Helps that her dad, Harper Lee's dad, was the first person to encourage her to write when she was a young girl. And that if you watch, for example, the movie of To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch, even though he's the hero of the story, limps from an old injury, and spends the first two scenes of the movie talking about how he's too old to play with his kids. You know, I think we are supposed to see Atticus Finch as much as a devoted father rather than a crusading, as well as a crusading white knight of an attorney. The trial doesn't start until page 100 of the book anyway.
Yeah. And I also think there's a lot, talk about books that really strike you in a different way as an adult. When you reread the book, and we did it last summer with our kids on a road trip, actually, you get how frightened Atticus was at certain points. And you understand, you know, from his perspective, how much is at stake.
Oh, absolutely. And almost in like three separate ways, you know. Not only what is at stake in for the fate of Tom Robinson, his client, but what is at stake for his own reputation and the safety of his family and the community. And then in a larger sense, given that grown-up Scout Finch is telling us this story, the idea that, you know, what I do, and this is Atticus, I'm being Atticus right now talking, what I do in this situation will probably imprint how my kids view me and view morality for a very long time. So the idea that one of the great struggles of parenthood is that young people are watching and taking it all in.
So The Great Gatsby, of course, is on this list. And I have to ask you, are you concerned that the big Baz Luhrmann picture will reintroduce the book to a generation or be a substitute for it? Do you worry about the, you know, kids skipping the book and watching the movie?
Well, actually, because I have seen Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge, I'm concerned that Gatsby is going to be entirely too subtle and quiet and understated for me. No, I'm kidding.
I was thinking maybe I saw that in a different theater than you did.
No. I think there's a lot of, you know, back doors and attic windows into great books. And I think, you know, Jesus, if we all had to come to them the same way, we would bottleneck very quickly at that door, and some of us would just turn around and go home. Some kids will watch The Great Gatsby, and they will admire it for the costumes and the music and the fabulousness of the movie stars, and that will be it. And that is always the case with anything. And some people will be curious enough to read the book. And I think, you know, and I think that kind of all comes out in the wash. I think when we get into either or games with books, we are fundamentally missing that movies give us one set of pleasures and books give us another set of pleasures and music a third. Mm-hmm. And I intend to avail myself of all of them, thank you very much, because none of them, you know, give us heart attacks or make us gain weight or make our bones frail or anything like that. So choosing seems to me like saying, here's three desserts and none of them will make you fat. Why not just eat one? I would prefer to eat all three.
Kevin Smokler has written for the LA Times and Fast Company. His new book is called Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. Kevin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're so welcome, Chris. This was great. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. We really appreciate that. We appreciate especially those of you who are helping us reach our goal. We have just two contributions to go for this hour of Think to make our goal for the hour. If you could be one of those, we would so appreciate it. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also do this online at kera.org. Join Bernardo Casal in Irving, Robert Kreith in Tyler, Joe Mills in Fort Worth, Amanda Norton in Fort Worth, Mary Troy in Dallas, Christopher and Catherine Olson in Arlington, and Laura Evans in Dallas. Welcome back, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris. We also want to thank Costanza Ward and Garland and Renee Lamb in Arlington. Also, thanks to Michael Sayers in Arlington and Maddie Jenkins in The Colony. Perhaps they picked up their very own copy of Kevin Smokler's book, Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. You can get your very own copy right now with a contribution of $120 or just $10 a month to KERA. Go online to kera.org or call 888-694-6931.
Your contribution to the station pays for a year of great radio for you, for your community. It pays for great journalism. You really contribute to the presence of quality local coverage, local shows like Think and Anything You Ever Wanted to Know that we're able to bring to you because of your support. And it pays our share of the NPR and PRI programs that you hear, American Public Media programs that you hear on this station as well. 888-694-6931 is the number, or go online to kera.org.
We are working on a huge challenge today from the BNSF Foundation. It's $5,000. It's at risk. We've got to hear from 350 of you loyal KERA listeners who want to support the station, who want to help KERA garner an additional $5,000 gift from the BNSF Foundation. This is really exciting to hear that we have this opportunity, because $5,000 goes an awfully long way here at KERA, and we know you love the station. We know you listen all the time. Well, all we're asking you to do is right now be one of the 350 standout listeners that we really need to hear from today. Just a couple more right now to make the goal for Think This Hour, our goal of 25 donations this hour, just looking for two more to go. But of course, that keeps us on track for the slightly less than 200 we still need to garner today in order to unlock this $5,000 additional gift.
If you never miss listening to Think, or you try never to miss it, it's part of your midday routine every day, or it's part of your evening routine if you listen in the 9 to 11 hours, you really shouldn't miss an opportunity to support the station, because you can choose how much to give. The sustaining memberships go from $5 a month up, but you can give a one-time gift in any amount. For some of you, that might be a substantial amount of money. Some of you, it might just be, you know, a few dollars to say, I appreciate KERA. I want there to be public radio in my community. You can make the choice, but we really ask that everyone who relies on the station provides some of the funding necessary to keep it strong.
Yeah, that's how it works. I mean, that's the beauty of public radio. We're not beholden to big advertisers. There aren't big advertisers, first of all, and they would never call and say, kill this story that makes our company look bad, because it's just not how it works. Not necessarily that that's how it works in the commercial world, but it's a different world out there. And public radio is different. That's why you kept listening once your radio searching finger found KERA and found public radio. You came back again. You thought, wow, that's an interesting perspective. Wow, they spent 8 minutes on this story. Wow, Chris Boyd talked to that guest for an entire hour. I want to listen some more. And, you know, the years went by and you kept listening and you kept learning about things from the public radio perspective. Well, now maybe you've missed every membership campaign before. You just automatically happened to take vacations or sort of check out when we were on the air asking for your support. Well, but now you're hearing our message and you know that it's your contribution that helps pay the bills here.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. Looking for an additional 189 contributions to make that BNSF challenge, which will give this station an additional $5,000 to serve you. Need two in this hour of Think in order to keep up with our individual goals. We want to make sure that we're doing, that Think is doing its part, that Think listeners are doing their part. You can do this now. If KERA is number one on your presets, or if all the other preset buttons broke and you don't care because you listen only to KERA and you have not made a contribution, goodness, join your friends and neighbors and some of your colleagues and support the station. You'll actually feel great about it. There's no buyer's remorse when you give money to KERA, because you tune in, as always, every single day and hear great content.
I was buying a pair of running shoes the other day, Chris, and the guy behind the counter looked at my credit card and he goes, oh, wait a minute. I do you work at KERA? I said, yeah, I do. He goes, oh, wow, I really love the Think Show. I said, oh, thanks so much. I work on the Think Show. He goes, oh, I really need to renew my membership. Immediately he said that, and I said, well, it is membership week.
Did you get a discount on your sneakers, or did he decide to call in later?
No, he didn't. He you know, hopefully he'll call in. I bet he will. He's a really nice guy. And, you know, everybody's got the best intentions. You've been meaning to give to the station. It seems like it's a huge, big deal to do. It seems like it might be, you know, a lot to do, but it's really not. It's like, you know, purchasing anything online, supporting any cause online, takes a couple of minutes. when you go to kera.org, or when you call 888-694-6931. A very friendly person will walk you through the membership process. You'll be done. You'll feel great about it. And then when you see Chris at the store or you see me out, you can say, hey, I renewed my membership during membership week.
And we are, trust me, we will be so happy and we will say thank you.
We'll do a little dance.
We want to thank Kevin Smokler for his participation this hour. Remember, you can receive a copy of his book, Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. That's available as a thank you gift when you make a contribution at 1-888-694-6931. You can also do this online at kera.org. 176 contributions to go in order to make the BNSF Challenge. Thanks.